Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community. As Drs. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on 97.9 The Hill and on demand at chapelboro.com.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. I want to welcome back Dr. Jamil Battle as our great guest co-host. Welcome, Jamil. How are you doing today?
Thank you for having me back. I'm doing fantastic.
Well, good. I'm doing pretty good, too. And we're going to have a great conversation today with Dr. Eli Adashi, professor of medical science and former dean of medicine at Brown University, about the ethics of editing genetic material. Even the thought of that makes me a little scared. But he's like one of the experts nationally, internationally, on this topic.
And it sounds like this is going to be an exciting topic to explore, indeed.
But first, we have some exciting research that matters. Let's dive right in, maybe even some little controversy. The very first one's about an ingestible capsule that can be remotely controlled, I guess, on a smartphone, for which you could take it and perhaps deliver a drug over a period of time to the right place at the right time. What?
Well, you know, we are in exciting times with medical breakthroughs, and so we're using our devices anyway. Why not incorporate this science? What did it show?
Well, these were some researchers at Brigham and Women's Hospital and MIT who were using 3D printing technology. So you can manufacture this, and they manufacture a device in which these are drugs can be put in. And this device, the way it's manufactured, could stay in your stomach or your small intestine maybe for a month. This particular device has a battery in it. I think it's some sort of electric battery. And then that can transmit through Bluetooth technology. And I think the idea here is that you may be able to diagnose. Maybe someone has an ulcer. You can't really see it, can't figure it out. Maybe someone has a disease and you're trying to pick it up early or understand it. So it's using technology to then record and get all this information, perhaps in a way that's less invasive, though, I don't know, swallowing a capsule that has a battery in it, a silver oxide battery, in fact, doesn't sound like to me something I necessarily want to do, but maybe it's okay.
I think it's okay. And it also talks about how, you know, it could maybe help patients maintain strict dosing of regimens required. For example, patients maybe with HIV or malaria or TB that, you know, take some pretty complicated regimens or maybe even monitor people that are at high risk for infection that are receiving chemo. And if the infection comes, the capsule can somehow detect that and then start releasing antibiotics. And they're talking about alternative power sources, such as maybe using the stomach acid or an external antenna instead of the battery.
Yeah, I know you're making it better for me, and I know that I need to kind of get on the technology bent here. We're going to be talking about research that matters soon. So I do understand that. I think there's a lot of potential here. I also could see it being used in certain situations where perhaps, you know, we have a lot of patients that are struggling with, let's say, a weight. And perhaps the sensor could go off when it detects excess amount of food coming into the stomach or the stomach increasing at a certain volume or making you eat slower, and then perhaps giving a little buzz or shock some feedback to your remote phone to let you know, hey, don't do this.
I need that one.
Well, I think a lot of people could use that. So I think we're going to look forward to the next iteration of this. This next study, though, we don't need a next iteration. We're ready for it now. And this is ways of helping alleviate depression by getting out more often. I want to volunteer for this study, the next iteration.
Yes, this one was done with researchers at University College London, published in British Journal of Psychiatry, and they found that just like we know that there's benefits to eating our fruits and vegetables and being active, that cultural activities have similar benefits.
Yeah, in this particular case, there was a 32% lower risk of developing depression with those who went out and did these cultural activities once or a month or more and the more often they did it, they even had a lower overall risk. And this was like going to museums or opera or theater. I wanted to know that they paid for it, though. You know, no, I mean, that's a serious question, because if people have to pay for it,
that's true,
and the cost of it, maybe the benefit isn't as great. You know, I mean, I sometimes go see a movie and it's not a very good movie, you know, right. And then I'm going, God, I paid $20 for this ticket and another $10 for popcorn that was old, stale, and too salty. You're like, ah, maybe I should have stayed home, but maybe I could watch that at home. Do you have to go out, or is there a social interaction? These are just interesting questions they don't answer, but I think there's something here.
There really is. And I think they think that it's the combination of the social interaction piece, creativity, that mental stimulation. But this also needs to be done regularly, just like when we exercise. We can't just run on the 1st of January and still have the benefit.
So I might not get the same benefit if I'm just watching it on TV rather than engaging and getting up and moving. There's some aspect of getting out.
That's right.
A lot to be learned there. Next research that matters is something else to be learned, and that is, do we get the same amount of calories when we eat out at a full-service restaurant or a fast food restaurant? I would have thought in some circumstances we might actually get more at the fast food restaurant because of the types of foods they're eating, but I would have been wrong.
You certainly would have. This study looked at, it sounds like, meals from 5 countries, Brazil, China, Ghana, Finland, India. And what they found actually is that there were more calories in the full service restaurants. And this is very important given this global kind of obesity epidemic that's not only affecting the U.S., but internationally.
Right. There were over 1,300 calories in a full service meal and 800 calories in a fast food meal. So we can't just blame the fast food companies here, right?
Right.
It's restaurants in general that are, you know, because you go out and you maybe have a salad and you have a plate and then you might have dessert. Whereas fast food restaurant, you just may just get the hamburger or the burrito. You don't get all these other things. I think they both have a place and they both have problems.
They just certainly do.
And we probably need to be cooking more with fresh fruits and vegetables and nuts and fish more often at home and eating out a little bit less frequently. That's just my opinion.
Yep.
I could be wrong.
I think you're right about that, actually. And, you know, as our lives become busier, maybe we can figure out ways to cook and in a shorter period of time and it still be less calories and then possibly abate or ward off the epidemic with obesity.
Sounds very good. Our last research that matters is actually about altering our brain waves to think more creatively. And I'm not just talking about science fiction here. We're talking about the essence of creativity. What are we talking about?
Well, it looks like scientists at Queen Mary University of London and Goldsmith looked at alpha oscillations in the right temporal area of the brain, and this was published in Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. And what they found is alpha activity suppresses misleading associations in the creative tasks. Can you break that down for us?
Well, yes. First off, we have to break it down by saying, what's a task? And then we have to go a little bit further. So a task might be something we do. Something we do might be when we get together. When we get together, maybe something social. So all of a sudden, we're thinking social, where before we were thinking task. And when we think about that social, when we deconstructed it, perhaps that opens up possibilities. And so that's what they're talking about here, which I found really interesting, which is to break down something into all the constituent processes, which allows us to kind of dissect creativity. In so doing, perhaps we're stimulating these alpha oscillations in the temporal region. I love that. And that's allowing us to then take something progressively more remote, but in doing that, that opens up creative pathways. I think this is really interesting, and it opens up some really interesting research, particularly, let's say, in the research process that we do in medicine.
And it certainly speaks to taking a less traveled route and pathway in that brain for opening up the doors to creativity.
You know, our research today, we were in London and Ghana and all over the place. We need to do some traveling here to go look at these places, Jamil. I'm just saying.
I agree there.
Well, that'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We'll take a short break, but when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Eli Adashi, professor of medical science and former dean of medicine at Brown University, about the ethics of editing genetic material. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Jamil Battle. We'll be right back.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Jamila Battle. Today on Conversations, Jamila, we're talking with Dr. Eli Adashi, professor of medical science and former dean of medicine and biological sciences at Brown University, about the ethics of editing genetic material. Welcome to Your Health, Dr. Adashi.
My pleasure.
You know, it's really great to have you on the show, and we're going to be talking about a recent article that you wrote in the Journal of the American Medical Association. But I think we'd like to know a little bit more about you first. How did you get so interested? And for our listeners, they should know that you have had an extraordinary career in so many different roles in science and leadership and education. How did you get interested so long ago in this type of career?
Well, as you know, I'm an obstetrician gynecologist by training, and a reproductive endocrinologist by subspecialty training, which is to say I always had an interest in issues related to reproduction. And editing the genome of the human embryo has, of course, everything to do with reproduction, but it has to do with much more than just reproduction. And it combines science with reproductive biology, with ethics, probably with the law. It has a lot to digest. And so a topic such as this is one I get naturally attracted to, and we have been working in this area consistently for some time now, in general focusing on leading-edge reproductive technologies and what they mean to ethics, to medicine, to the law, to society at large.
Really, really, really interesting.
And with this, it sounds like this is kind of a complicated area. Can you break it down exactly when you're talking about genetic editing, what that means?
So genetic editing could be likened to word processing in a way, except that the substrate is the genome as opposed to a Word document. Just as we can, in a context of word processing, replace one letter with another, maybe one word with another, sometimes a whole paragraph with another. So in principle, although this technique has yet to be perfected, in principle, we are now increasingly in a position to replace one base, for example, of DNA with another, perhaps a series of bases, perhaps a gene or parts of a gene with another, all of which opens up a number of possibilities, which I imagine we will be discussing as we proceed.
If I asked people and patients around me, would you feel it's okay if we could make genetic alterations to cure muscular dystrophy? I imagine every patient would say, absolutely, it's the greatest promise. What's the problem? Why is that, or maybe not that, but things like that, controversial?
It probably is multi-layered. And so it's not as if there is a single and or simple objection. One of the most profound forces here at play is the difficulties humanity in general has and had with scientific breakthroughs, with developments that take us to a different level, which raise all kinds of fears in the process. This goes back to time immemorial. You can think about Galileo and others who over the years have produced scientific breakthroughs. And there are two variables really that play out here usually, the most important of which is time. While the generation that lives at the time when a scientific breakthrough transpires finds it difficult to accommodate it, that is usually far less of a problem with the children of that generation or the grandchildren of that generation, who generally are accepting of the new development. This is not unlike some of the social changes that we see happening in society. It would have been unthinkable 50 or 100 years ago to imagine, let's say, same-sex marriage. However, if you were to ask your son or daughter or grandson or granddaughter today about it, all you're likely to get back in return is a blank stare. I call this the blank stare test. They don't even know what you're talking about, because to them it's completely natural and is part of the universe they were born into. Some of the same is operational when it comes to scientific breakthroughs, and these developments or this ontogeny of science and the acceptance of society have been nicely documented in some very fine books, meaning scientific contributions, that have sort of gone through the stages of acceptance of a scientific breakthrough. But the initial response tends to be negative, at least initially, mostly out of fear, a sense of lack of familiarity, what this might be doing to humanity, how it affects one's religious beliefs. And so the going tends to be difficult at the outset, but it takes about a generation or two to get past that issue.
Yeah, I'm thinking about in my lifetime, before organ transplantation was so widespread and the death was not just the cessation of the heart, but it could be cessation of recognizable brain activity, and then the heart could still be beating, and then all of a sudden organ transplantation can take off.
Right. And I'm sure that's far less acute at this point. The interesting biblical analogy of all of this is the Exodus from Egypt, which, as you recall, took about 40 years, or at least so we are told. And during that time, the idea was to have only the newborn generation enter the Promised Land. In fact, Moses himself was not allowed to enter the Promised Land. All that he was allowed to do was stand on top of the mountain and look in. It was ultimately Joshua who led the Israelites into the Promised Land. And the whole idea was, according to God, was to see to it that those Israelites who knew Pharaoh really would not be ready to take on that assignment. So it takes a generation or two for these novel ideas to sink in, to be accepted, and to become the norm. The discovery of gene editing is now all of 6 years old. But to be precise even, or to, in terms of humanity, 5 years old. So you can imagine we are in the newborn stage here. We have, you know, hardly reached infancy. And clearly this is brand new, and it takes a whole lot to adjust to it.
Well, we're going to need to take a short break, but then we're going to have to come back and talk about this wandering in the desert. And I'm hoping we don't have to wander for 40 years here.
It's always good to remember those old stories, mm-hmm. because they bring value to the conversation.
Mm-hmm. We'll take a short break, and when we return, we'll continue talking with Dr. Eli Adashi, professor of medical science and former dean of medicine and biological sciences at Brown University, about the ethics of editing genetic material. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Jamila Battle. Stay with us.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health, and we're talking with Dr. Eli Adashi, professor of medical science and former dean of medicine and biological sciences at Brown University, about the ethics of editing genetic material. And we talked about time as being the critical piece to shifting to breakthroughs and new heights. But once we shift, there seems to always be this kind of potential risk-benefit ratio. Can you tell us a little bit about the potential risk and benefits of this rapidly developing science?
Well, there are probably at least two things that are useful to say at the outset. I mentioned earlier that the technology is far from ready for clinical use, and that is because it is far from perfect. Worse, it can bring about stochastic, that is to say random, loss of genetic material, rearrangement of genetic material, all of which, while potentially usable in the context of laboratory research, is not acceptable when it comes to patient care. And so one major reason that this technology is not ready for any form of clinical application that is not relatively simple and carefully validated is because the technology is just not quite there yet. And that's not always widely appreciated. When you edit a human embryo and you introduce changes that were not intended, that are not even appreciated, those changes will then be carried down the generations. And some of those may well have unforeseen effects. The very reason, or perhaps one of the major reasons, not the only reason, there was a great deal of consternation in the wake of the reports from China of the editing of human embryos, was that there was a good likelihood, there is a good likelihood, that the two babies who were born may or may not have had the intended effect that the process had in mind, but may have also acquired challenges that they weren't counting on, that could then be transmitted to their children and grandchildren, etc. So one of the main issues with the technology right now really has to do with its ability to deliver what's intended or promised. The other issue, which I think to some degree was addressed in the paper that caught your attention, has to do with the objectives this technology will be used for. The therapeutic objective, which we have just briefly discussed, is understandable and by and large is accepted by the majority of the American people based on recent polls. About 60 to 70% of Americans would want to see this technology eventually used for the prevention of heritable diseases. There is much more resistance and or consternation about the possibility of using this technology to so-called enhance the human condition, which is to say to improve certain properties, be they physical or cognitive, and create so-called superhumans or improved versions of humanity. That is at this point not technically feasible, and so it's mostly a theoretical conversation But in theory, at some point, it could become an issue. And that has already caught the attention of a great number of people who are concerned about this potential development. So as one looks at the totality of the picture here, the two issues are, can we bring this technology to good use in the therapeutic sense and do so safely, which at this point is not quite where we are? And secondly, will we ever, as a people, proceed to produce measures of enhancement with an eye towards creating a humanity that is different, perhaps better than we currently observe? So in a nutshell, although there is much more to it, of course, this is perhaps a big picture outlook on what's possible and what is giving rise to some concern.
I wonder if I can ask you a question, because I think you've laid out really brilliantly the dilemmas here, which is that technology will continue. It may not be acceptable today. It may be acceptable tomorrow. And how we shape that technology in the best way to avoid these ethical and conflicts and unintended consequences. If you were advising the bodies, and you probably are, of how to best achieve that, because there's also, you know, technology that people use for nefarious purposes, right? They would take this and say, how do we create something that's also more powerful? How would you advise that those safeguards get built into to prevent the abuse of the technology?
Well, I would say that everybody, including me, who is involved in this area, appreciates and expects that it will be subject to appropriate regulatory oversight. In the United States, you cannot undertake gene editing without being subject to the purview of the FDA. If you choose to bypass the FDA, which we could theoretically speculate could happen, you'd be breaking the law. And we have some precedents of that. And there is no likelihood that this will end without some serious consequences to the perpetrators. So, you know what they say about burglary. If somebody is intent on breaking in, they will find a way. But there are consequences. And the same is true here. You cannot proceed with either therapy, let alone enhancement, which is not even feasible today, without going through the FDA, which is, as you know, the oldest consumer protection agency in the United States and has done in many ways a yeoman's job over the last 100 years to be sure that the medications we use, the devices we use, the food we eat, the cosmetics we use are safe and efficacious. And gene editing technology falls right under that. There is a branch within the FDA that is legally authorized to oversee this area, and the FDA is on top of it in many ways. And I'd like to think, and I feel comfortable when I say this, that in the United States at least, the likelihood of this technology being used improperly or abused always exists, but are very small and not without consequence.
And I share that sentiment for sure, being optimistic about that. Before we wrap up, are there any final thoughts that you would like to share with us and our listeners?
I will just point out perhaps that the paper that drew your attention was an effort to represent a recent report by the so-called Nuffield Council on Bioethics from the United Kingdom, which laid out its views on the editing of the human embryo, or what they called heritable human editing. What stood out in that report was its progressive position. It found both therapeutic and enhancing editing to be ethically acceptable, subject to certain terms. And in that respect, they were ahead of the curve, because even in the United States, the National Academies, for example, made a clear distinction between therapy and enhancement. The United Kingdom, which is a far more secular nation than we are, and is known for its common sense, is taking very different positions on these matters, including matters of reproduction. And so we thought it was interesting to highlight that without necessarily taking position, but illustrating the kind of reasoning that they undertook to arrive at the conclusions that they ended up reporting.
Yeah, I know. In your article, which we're going to link on our website, you talk about the dilemma, or that we're much more than genes. We're much more than genes are us, and that this social nature and the parenting and the environment, all these things create who we are. And so that's just one nature. And we're always doing things in our environment to change and in betterment. So that may be, I guess, how the British may have looked at this in a broader way.
Correct.
Yeah. Well, we really want to thank you, Dr. Eliadashi, for writing an article that is an important article that our listeners can read, and for helping explain this in ways that I think help us all perhaps understand that this is on the horizon, and we should understand it better. So thank you so much on behalf of Your Health listeners for being our guest today.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
We've been talking with Dr. Eliadashi, Professor of Medical Sciences and former Dean of Medicine at Brown University, about the ethics of editing genetic material. We're going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Jamil Battle. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Jamil and I are going to spend a few minutes talking about listener health questions and concerns. If a listener wants to address any topic on an upcoming show, they can send comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question. Laura?
I went to see my family doctor because I had recently seen two subspecialists relating to my allergies. One of them said I should have surgery to fix the problem, and the other one said I shouldn't. I thought my family doctor could break the tie, but she instead asked me which choice felt right to me. I told her my gut said I shouldn't have surgery because the doctor who said I didn't need the surgery certainly could have made some money by doing it anyway. I realized my family doctor didn't actually answer my question, but helped me figure out the right answer for myself instead.
What, you know, what's this family doctor doing here? I mean, just break the tie. Flip a coin. I mean, you know, what do you mean? This patient-centered kind of stuff, asking the patient what their gut would be.
Well, we're here to guide, and it's not to be paternalistic, but to help the patient kind of figure out what's best for them and make, you know, an informed decision.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. I think this is a great approach in this particular case, because you got two subspecialists, both of which may have arrived at their opinions for reasons that would make sense to them. And, you know, what's a patient to do? And so sometimes, you know, I oftentimes think, well, you know, you probably have some sense for yourself as to what maybe feels best. And they both could be right. I mean, I guess if you felt a surgery would be best for this patient, you would have said that, right?
I sure would have.
If you felt it wasn't best, you would have said that.
I would have hinted at it.
But you may not have had an opinion either.
Right.
So you're trying to elicit those values for the patient.
And then just lay out the pros and cons so that they can make the decision that's best for them.
Yes, I think you're absolutely right. It's laying those out there, but ultimately is trusting your instincts at times. I mean, you know, your instincts say, maybe I shouldn't do it because maybe it's not an allergy problem that was causing this. Maybe there was something else causing it. And, you know, the surgery may not hurt you, but you know what? It's expensive and it's painful. And to then go through it and it not help you, that could be a problem.
That certainly could.
Laura, what's our very next house call?
I'm an elderly woman with anxiety. I've had it all my life, but when I go see my doctor, it's even worse. My doctor, however, spends the first 5 or so minutes of every visit telling me jokes and asking me about my family before his assistant then comes in to take my blood pressure and my pulse. This seems to always help me relax, and I wonder how frequent that approach is. I've heard a lot about patient-centered care, and I think this fits that definition.
Ding, 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 ding. Yeah, I think that's another example of this patient-centered care, which, you know, a lot of times think of these big, amazing, large things that we have to really do this, but sometimes it's really small things.
I think it's just common sense things.
You think so?
I do.
I don't know. I think a lot of times in our, you know, we have certain ways of doing things. You know, the nurse brings the patient back. They take the blood pressure, you know, and there's so much pressure to get those things done and ask the 54,000 questions that we have to ask before the doctor ever sees you. And there's just a lot of pressure there. It's not so easy just to stop for a few minutes, relax, and have some fun.
And that's certainly what patient-centered care is all about.
You know, I'd say this is, I'd keep this doctor if I was this patient. In fact, I want to go see that doctor because, you know, a doctor that can just sit there and, you know, who doesn't get a little anxious? I get a little anxious before they take my blood pressure. What if all of a sudden it's up this one time, you know?
Right.
I don't really want that or, you know.
Or to be put on medicine if it's up just one time.
Right. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for that house call. Laura, what's our very last one?
I used to have high blood pressure that was not well controlled, and I ended up needing to take 2 to 3 medications. I was also under a lot of marital stress around this time. Over the past 5 years, my husband and I have both gotten older, and our children have left the house, and we seem to fight less often and don't seem to be as stressed. When I recently went to my doctor, my blood pressure was actually low for the first time in a long time. Do you think I could go off my medications?
Well, there's a lot going on in this particular case. It seems kind of straightforward. We hear the narrative in terms of cause and effect here. But what are some first thoughts that you have, Jamila?
I would always want to say, okay, is there something else going on? I mean, are you dehydrated or, you know, is there some underlying infection? Just something that maybe could bottom out the blood pressure other than stress.
Like you have some kidney problems and those blood pressure medicines are staying in your system a lot longer. Right. Not so obvious unless you check the kidney function.
Right. Mm-hmm. And then once we kind of rule out some of those underlying, you know, reasons, maybe peeling back, because you certainly may need to titrate down certain medications, monitor the blood pressure at home and write that down and then give that feedback to your doctor.
Yeah, I think there's a misperception that exists that whatever happened today is going to be true tomorrow. And we see a lot of times things change, circumstances change, stress levels change. You were in that job that was so stressful, and then all of a sudden you're not in that job anymore, and that stress level gets a lot better. And we find out all of a sudden your blood pressure goes down. That's not an unusual story. It's one we wish we would hear more often, that people are in less stressful situations. Mm-hmm. You know, I just also think that it's, you know, it's kind of interesting here. Was it the children leaving the house that made it better, or was it the less fighting with the husband? I don't know, or the spouse. It's certainly... or maybe just slowing down.
Oh,
maybe
children leaving down the house. That's what it was.
You're just waiting for that one. I'm a year out of that. I'm feeling really good, ready to go on a vacation. Well, that'll conclude our house call today. And we want to thank all of you joining us today for your health. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns important to you. You can share any story or question by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or iTunes. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship. I want to thank our great guest today, Dr. Eli Adashi, and I want to thank my guest co-host, Dr. Jamila Battle. We hope you join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Jamila Battle.
And we'll look forward to talking to you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health on demand at chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, your community radio station.